prospect of receiving an affirmative vote on, they're going to say, yeah, we're ready to go. At that point, in our minds, everything up to that point is kind of a scoping, negotiating process, and we really don't know what is represented on both sides of the exchange equation. On one side, you have the native in holdings. We know pretty much what those look like, and I can discuss those with you in a fair amount of detail if you'd like to talk about those. On the other side, we don't know what they're going to get, and we won't know for several weeks yet. But, I mean, we're moving forward as fast as we can on that issue. At that point, we will come forward to in numerous forums to the public and lay all of this out. And Bill Horn's letter responds specifically to this in terms of how you best represent the public's interest. I understand, and I wish I could be more responsive to your concern, but it's a question of at what point do we bring this thing forward in a way that it is timely and at the same time does represent the public interest and answers more questions than it raises. I think the kind of thing we get involved in very, very early and to a certain degree we have in these hearings is without knowing what you're going to get up there and without knowing that the native corporations are going to want to proceed and that we're willing to proceed, we get into the realm of speculation in terms of impacts, for example, up in the Arctic. At this point, we don't know what tracks they're going to get. We don't know what the values are. We don't know where they're located. We don't know the configuration. And our sense is until when we get to that point, then we have a package, a proposal that we can take forward to the public. At the same time, we'll begin, and we are looking at developing the administrative record necessary to do that. Once we have completed all that, then we would take a recommendation to the secretary. And we'd say, okay, here's what we've been able to work out with the native corporations, and if the state is at the table with the state, here's the kind of reaction we have gotten from the public, here's the kind of reaction we have gotten from the Public Land Use Council, here's the kind of reaction we've gotten from the good senators. And based on that, here's our recommendation, Mr. Secretary. And he and his considered judgment then would to make a call as to whether to proceed or not. At that point, it all begins to come together. And it's a matter of developing this thing in such a way that first of all, we can put all the pieces of the puzzle together in a scoping sort of way, and that's what we're doing now, and then take it forward for consideration. So
just one point of observation, John, sure. And then Senator Jones. That is the reason why you're going forward with both of these, with the negotiations of the land, is to send the message to Udall, send the message to Bennett Johnson, send the message to these people so that the native people can send the message to the environmental community that is nudging the secretary to make a favorable,
No, sir, I don't think that's the intent at all. I see that there being three rationales for the timing. And this is something that has come up time and time again. Let me see if I can present you with my views on this, and I think they represent the department's views. Number one, we're dealing with willing sellers here. We don't have the authority to condemn out or in any other way pursue acquisition of these inholders. Yeah. We're dealing with willing sellers.
Right.
The native corporations have come to us as willing sellers and have told us that they want to negotiate. And it represents, as I think Mr. Luska pointed out, a window of opportunity. And because of the stakes that are involved here, we don't believe that it's prudent to pass up that opportunity. We believe we need to pursue that opportunity. Okay. That's one aspect of it. The second aspect is the complexity, just the simple nature, the complexity, the variety of interests that are represented at the table. We've been meeting with some of these corporations going on to 3 years. Clearly, if we were to wait until there was congressional legislation before we had even begun to scope this out, they saw it, and I think we see it, as very likely that we would not be able to put together a package, an exchange package, in a timely way so that we would be able to affect that between the time legislation is passed and there might be a leasing program.
Okay.
And third, and maybe this is the most important consideration, both from the Native perspective as sellers and our perspective as buyers, the fact that they are at the table now and that these agreements may be sitting on the shelf awaiting congressional action at a time, if not similar to the time they might be considering a 1002 opening shortly thereafter, represents substantial value. It represents value to the Native corporations because they're going to be able to go in advance of a lease sale and explore. And quite frankly, a considerable amount of the upfront money, I believe, that they might receive as a participant to this exchange is contingent upon that prospect.
Okay.
Now, that translates to inholdings from our perspective because for every dollar they receive, less their costs, the net revenues they receive, translates into land that we will actually keep. So there's some real incentive in terms of the exchange participants' interests on both sides of the equation to having these things in place in such a way that they can move forward in a timely manner, because there is a significant amount of value attached to the timing. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps. That helps. I could see that reason. I figured that the other one was that it helped propel it along because of that last one, because of the values that there was. That there's an overriding issue of whether the refuge should be open or whether it shouldn't be open, and the land trades, whether we like to recognize it or not, bring the issue to the table where that it's not just a federal lease program up there. That's what you're really saying, isn't it, John?
Well, certainly it is another issue, and it's an issue that's riding on a parallel track, but I think I need to reiterate that the Secretary is not a part of any of this at this point.
That's right.
The Secretary's decision on the 1002 opening is totally independent, and it would seem to me like the point at which the Secretary makes the call about the balancing of interests, as I think I mentioned to you before, is the point at which the agency and the assistant secretaries go forward with a recommendation to the Secretary. And quite frankly, I would expect that we are several months away from doing anything, and so the Secretary is not in a position to...
When you said several months away from doing anything, then the window is still there for the state to come in once the decision has been made by the Secretary whether the plane should be opened or not.
Certainly, I would expect so, Senator, but it's a question, I think Mr. Gilmore referred to this in last week's testimony, although the testimonies and the hearings are beginning to run together a little bit in my mind. It's a question of whether you're on the first train or if there's going to be a second train.
I think that's it.
Right now, we're working on the first train, and it's composed of 5 participants, and it was 6 with the state there, and we will move forward on that as expeditiously and judiciously as possible. If at some point in the future the state decides they want to come to the table, then it would seem to me like that's a legitimate prospect, but the first train may already be gone, and the tracks
right.
may, some of the most prospective
Steven.
Tracks may have already
yeah.
been identified.
And Senator Jones, then Senator Dunn.
That leads me right to my question. We're looking at looking at this thing, it's like
right.
a bowl of jelly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and a jello, like jello, and it's setting up. It sets up slow, and as it sets up, it takes away the chance of anybody putting another ingredient in there to be part of that, because once she sets, that's it. So let's get, and I see the state, you know, I want to make sure we're doing the right thing, okay, Tom, Gary? This train's going down the track, and we're, every day that it's pulling away, it's getting further away, and we're not able to get on. That's what I'm afraid of. One of the cards you're talking about is that one of the reasons the state pulled away is that we don't know as much about what's going on, what's out there, as the native corporations and the oil companies or any partners they may have, the industry side. But I see in this method of selecting tracks and putting it in and pooling those tracks, and then anyone is able to come in and select any of the ones nominated. I mean, that it's going to be a pool of what everybody nominates. So that gives the state the right to select a track that the native corporation might have put in also.
That's right.
So I see that as kind of mitigating that problem. And also, from testimony in the past weeks, we understand, yes, there is 26 geologic structures out there that look better than any of the rest, but testimony from industry and geologists say that just because that area looks the best structurally doesn't mean that's where the oil will be found. That in fact, in a lot of cases, it's found outside of those areas. Do we really know that we're taking a licking on this, and aren't we going to be, if the state's back at the table, aren't we going to be able to geologically determine, as well as anybody else, where that oil is?
Senator Jones, I believe earlier you mentioned that we're gambling with our interests. It seems to me that that's exactly the best descriptor to use about this particular process. The stakes are sky high. Unless we've got the surety of knowing what we're getting into, it's a process that has not only pitfalls, but disastrous consequences. That's what we're cognizant of. The scenario you mentioned, whereby the native corporations nominate the tracks, thereby the state has the knowledge of knowing what the native corporations nominate, is true. But one thing you have to remember is that when the state left the table, there was a provision for a nomination of 15 tracks per participant. I don't know if that's changed or not, but take that times 6, that's 90 tracks. That's still a heck of a big area to choose from. You also don't know, because all of the native corporations are not created equal with their information base, which native corporations have nominated which tracks. Only two, to the best of our knowledge, only two of the native corporations have the kick well data. Well, I think you understand where I'm coming from. I'm not sure at all that that is an advantage to the state. My point is, it's still a very risky undertaking. And we're proceeding from the assumption that we have 90-10. And anything less than 90-10 is a loss to the state of Alaska.
But Mr. Chairman, it's curious to me, and I would be interested to know what information the state has that we don't have that suggests that, in fact, two of the native corporations have the Kip Donald data. To my knowledge, that's not true, and I'd be interested in any evidence they would have that suggests that.
Well, it's our partners, isn't it, John? Aren't they partners?
Yeah, but that does not necessarily translate, in my mind, to the fact that that their industry partner is going to convey to a Native corporation to kick downhole data.
Mr. Chairman, they're not going to, you know, give them that information, but I'm sure some fingers are going to be pointing on where they're, by the industry partners, as to where the Native corporations ought to be selecting tracks, and that's the point. I don't think anybody doubts that for a second.
Let me follow up on something, Mr. Chairman.
You bet.
You said that there will be six participants.
Senator Jones, right now there would be five if the state is not at the table.
Well,
if
the state was at the table, there would be six. So whether or not, isn't it based on the amount of value that you have in trades? I mean, isn't the state actually a larger participant than any one of those?
We don't know that. Again, hypothetically, if the state was still in the trades, the fact that you may have the most acreage does not necessarily mean that you'll have the most value. Values had not, when we left the table, had yet to be negotiated or finalized for, as far as I know, any of the participants, and we had barely even started negotiating values on behalf of the state. So yes, there, I suppose, is some correlation. If you got a lot of acreage, you probably would have a lot of value, but that's not necessarily the case. John can articulate better for you how the valuation process is structured, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is basically placing a much higher value on certain tracks than others.
Senator Jones, the concept at present, and this is all being negotiated, and I'm a little bit hesitant to get into too much detail because it'll be subject to discussions. In fact, the negotiations are underway right now. Calls for, as Gary said, 15 tracks to be identified. And what this represents is trying to reach a position in terms of our interest, the federal government's interest, in conveying information on all of the tracks up there, and at the same time providing a sufficient number of tracks and a sufficient opportunity for the participants to pursue an identification process by which they could equalize their value. And just as a matter of additional information, we have run a mock of this thing, and there will be other mocks run because the stakes are high, and to make sure it works. And on our first mock run, it did work, and it worked reasonably well. And I dare say, it's interesting to me, one of the smaller participants in the exchange who came in last, Old Harbor Native Corporation, has been able to stay at the table. They don't have, to my knowledge, any special information. And they're going to be there for tract identification, to the best of my knowledge. So I have a little trouble in terms of the rationale for this information issue. I personally feel like I would be reasonably comfortable after reading the 1002 report and knowing where the structures are and looking at the tracks of nominating some tracks myself and based on what other folks had nominated going in and making reasonable selections.
I wouldn't have to have very many selections because I'd pick right smack in the middle of wherever they all were picking.
The other thing that I think is important, there's a component in here where any track that is nominated by more than one participant is going to be highlighted in a different way, so you even know if more than one participant nominated more than a track more than once. So if it's highly prospective, there's a good chance that more than one participant will have nominated it.
Well, I just ask one more question.
All right. If we stay at the table, we go down the road, and we play the game right along with everybody else, and it gets accepted, everything goes. There's still a lot of land out there that could fall under the 90-10, or a lot of possibilities that could fall under the 90-10 if we won, or if that stays in place. Isn't that true? There's still a lot of possibilities there for oil, even after the exchanges.
Well, in the 1002 report, of course, there were 26 plays identified. There's 1.5 million acres in the coastal plain, so the answer is yes, there's a lot of area, but all tracts are not created equal by any stretch of the imagination. So, and for all we know, there still is the very distinct possibility, and I am not a geologist, but you've heard testimony on this issue before you, there may not be oil, there may not be gas, even besides the fact that there are some surface seepage and so on, and you've heard the favorable tendencies, but there's still a possibility that there may not be anything there, or anything in commercial quantities.
Senator Jones, one thing I think it might be important to point out, and I alluded to this in my opening comment, and it's further, it's not highlighted, but it's included in Bill Horn's letter, and it's on page 3. You might want to refer to that. In the second paragraph of page 3, it says, about a third of the way down, we are seriously considering making some tracts unavailable for identification.
Excuse me, page 3 of which document?
Of Assistant Secretary Horn's letter to Representative Cotton.
All right.
Page 3.
Mm-hmm.
Paragraph 2.
Okay.
And about a third of the way through that paragraph.
I see it.
Okay, we are seriously considering. And what that represents is a policy call that is under consideration at the assistant secretarial level right now that says, in effect, there may be, and it's likely, there will be some sort of constraint imposed on the selection or the identification process so that, and I think this represents obviously the state's interests and other private interests there, so that there will be certain areas up there that will probably not be available, or if potentially if a certain amount of a structure or a structure trend is consumed, that may be all that's allowed to be consumed by the exchange. So there's not only consideration of the impact of the exchange on a potential leasing program and state revenues in the context of the total acreage that's being considered, there's also consideration being made of what we refer to as a constraint policy that would preclude or likely preclude the prospect that we would exchange away large blocks and that, I think, would lessen the prospect that, for example, it would be a fortuitous kind of thing where the natives potentially would get in and hit the only structure up there in this exchange process. That, although, again, we're kind of in the realm of speculation here when you start dealing with that.
Yeah. Part of the speculation.
You know, I see this as a win-win situation for the state.
If I might. Perhaps this discussion this morning illustrates the very first point the governor made when he announced the fact that we were leaving the table. And that is, this detracts from the whole question of opening Anwar to responsible oil and gas development and focuses the entire dialogue on exchanges. And that's not the state's position. The state's position is we would like to see the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge opened to responsible oil and gas development, and that's what the congressional debate ought to be about. Now, that's not what the debate currently is about. It's about these exchanges, whether or not they're good, bad, or indifferent. If you look at the respective information that the parties have. If you have 90 balls in a sack, and there are six people picking those balls out in the track selection process, we know that two of them at least have industry partners that we presume, and I think it's a safe presumption, will be making at least having some influence on which ones they'll be picking out. That's information that neither the state has nor the federal government has. In addition, there are a variety of other concerns from the state's perspective as sovereign that do not, that are not satisfied here. Perhaps one of the biggest is 90-10. For those lands that do go into private ownership, 90-10 is lost. That's irrevocable. So the point of the point the governor was making is that from our perspective, these things don't advance our goal. And if they don't advance our goal, it is not in our interest to continue participating.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just pulling away from the table didn't change the focus. I mean, it didn't stop the negotiations. They're still going on. I don't understand that. I mean, you're saying, the governor is saying the real focus should be on opening ANWR, not on exchanges, and all the debates on exchanges, so we're going to get out of the picture. But that didn't change where the focus was.
Trying to get it.
No, the focus, Senator Duncan, was that the exchanges were determined not to be something that we could win by participating in. That's after a great deal of thought and understanding. And also, as I mentioned earlier, the paramount thing is, and I know Senator Coghill at least has been recently back in Washington, D.C., but the word on the Hill, frankly, is that exchanges do not have much support.
Go ahead, Senator Duncan.
Well, there's a whole
you've
lot.
Been trying
there were two or three questions I wanted to ask Gary about his opening statement, but I'm not sure how you decide that at this point, that exchanges don't have much support on the Hill. The Native corporations came before us last week and said that they believe that exchanges are the most important ingredient in getting ANWR open.
That's
because
it, it builds congressional support and it builds environmental support. It broadens the basic support for opening ANWR at all. You're saying the state disagrees with that?
Well, I think you saw by virtue of a lawsuit filed just the other day the nature of the environmental support.
Well,
it's
we're
very
not,
strong.
We're not sure. That's why I asked what the lawsuit meant, because I don't know what it means, whether it means it's not very strong or they want to be more involved in the exchange process so that they're sure that certain lands are involved in that exchange negotiation. I mean, you don't have an answer to that, do you?
No.
Let me ask you another question, Gary. Before we got into the legal aspects, you said, well, I'll let Tom talk about the legal reasons, and there's congressional approval of the land exchanges, and there's lawsuits we can enter into. But you said the state's position was you thought these exchanges were going to fail on their own accord. Could you just crystallize that for me? Why are they going to fail on their own accord? It sounds to me like the natives are very willing to discuss land exchanges with, and are very willing to do that. Why are they going to fail on their own accord?
Well, I said that for two reasons. First of all, the governor's representative in Washington, D.C., John Katz, obviously is much closer to this situation than I think anybody in this room. And he is in fairly constant contact with the people who count, Bennett Johnston and others. And his advice is at this time that the exchanges are diluting the effort to open the coastal plain. And chances right now, you're right, you can't guarantee anything in the Congress. I don't pretend to suggest that circumstances now may be the same as 5 years from now. We don't know how long this entire debate on opening is going to last, let alone the exchange debate. But at this point in time, prospects are not favorable.
So when you said their own accord, you didn't mean that negotiations were going to break down between the feds and the Native corporations?
No, I did not.
You think they will arrive at agreement on what the exchanges should be?
That's very possible. I can't say that for sure for all participants. I'm sure John would very much like to achieve closure on this process, but it's been going on now for several years. I don't know what its outcome will be, but that is very possible, yes.
Go ahead, Senator. You want to follow through on that?
No. Go ahead.
I want to accommodate all of you folks, and some of you want to try to go back on the afternoon flight, if you can. But it doesn't seem like we're getting, I haven't even started on my questions yet.
And Senator, maybe
we will get you out of here today, though. There's an evening flight, and I just I want to make sure, because we've got the geologists coming, but, you know, we have to go down the hill to a restaurant, so there's a van coming at 11:55 that we can all load in and go to a restaurant and eat and get back here as soon as possible. We can keep going with it. But, you know, I want to get down, and I guess we got about 6 or 7 minutes, and John, I don't know whether we could cover that subject in this time, but I'd like to have for the record for you to explain the selection pool and the, again, and how the tracks are available for selection. We talked about 15 tracts. Maybe we could identify, maybe Bruce could identify by the map that we've got there, basically where those tracts are. If you go into the 1002 report, you get a better map that selections in relationship to this pool that we're talking about, where the state should be in, and this the first train that leaves the station, and those 15 tracks are going to be on that train, and the second train that leaves might have other areas of the 1002 area open. And I guess I'm still confused as to where the relative values come in and how those relationships, and I can see where the state is confused in this thing, but the thing is that we have to stay on track to try and get those, the values of where, you know, like, let's take Togiak, or let's just take a narrow equation, or go right down to the hypothesis of taking Togiak and moving it through and how you evaluate that land and the wildlife value of that land to what may be underneath the ground. And if it's not under the ground, then what happens? And I guess that's the whole issue. But can you go through the selection process maybe before lunch, and they'll give us something to chew on whilst we're having a hamburger?
Certainly, Senator. And then I would be more than happy to take, for example, one hypothetical village corporation and kind of walk you through how the negotiation proceeds in terms of their value and how that value ultimately is translated into a subsurface interest, if you think that would be helpful.
But yeah.
Perhaps... And that could take a few minutes.
We'll do that after lunch, but if you can pool thing.
Let me talk about the pool a little bit. First of all, the base map that's behind you is a map that was prepared in some part because of our attempts to have a good base working map for the 1002 area for this process. What has been developed, which you do not have before you, is an overlay of that map that sets up a grid of tracks, and those grids are essentially, for the most part, there are four sections. You'll see those are individual section grids up there now, I believe. So a tract would be four of those small sections, roughly 2,560 acres. I say roughly and approximately because of the exterior and some deletions and so forth. Some of them obviously won't be squares, and they won't be 2,560 square or 2,560 acres. Corporation X, in all of their wisdom and with any help they can get from anybody, including hiring private consultants. And in fact, I believe the state at one point had a private consultant, will decide which tracks they are interested in, and they will identify and send to us in an envelope, a sealed envelope, 15 tracks that will be identified in two ways. They will identify them in the form of coordinates that are on this grid map, and they will also highlight the grid map so that we're clear that these are the nominations they're interested in.
Okay.
We will then collect all of those nominations, the 15 from the, let's say, five participants, to keep it simple at this point, which would equal 75 potential selections, right, or tracks that might be identified. They would, and the fact of the matter is, I think, that there's very likely that there will be duplication of nominations, so there will be something less than 75, and maybe only be 50. We will highlight all a similar grid map with all of those nominations, and also indicate where one participant, one native corporation, one or more than one, has, by an asterisk or some way, we will highlight any tracts that have been nominated by more than one party, and place a value on that. And then essentially, the five participants come into a room not too dissimilar to this probably, and we begin through a process, and they'll be looking at a map just like that one with an overlay on it, that will have all these sections of these tracks highlighted, and there'll be a value there. There'll be a number there, and there'll be a sheet that corresponds to that. Then the moderator, whoever's facilitating this process, will say, okay, we're ready to go into round one. You know, you can select any track up there, whether you nominated it or not. You get your first selection.
Will you pull a bingo tab out of a box on that?
No, Senator. What they would do is they would give us a sealed envelope with their selection in it. We'd have five sealed envelopes. We open the sealed envelopes, and if the tract is not contested, in other words, there's no conflict, no one else is selected, it would be that native corporation's assuming that they had sufficient value to buy that tract or trade that tract. And then that would be, that kind of, they write a check for that out of their checkbook, if you will. If there is conflict, there is a conflict resolution mechanism that is, again, subject to negotiation, but it basically has two components. The first part is the voluntary component, and clearly it's our hope that if there is conflict, that there would be a voluntary resolution of the conflict. In other words, the participants go off in some room and they're given a certain amount of time to try to resolve their conflict. If they cannot resolve it, then there is a means by which it will be resolved through an involuntary process, and I think I'm safe to say that one form of that will probably be a lottery if they can't form. I'm not sure what it's all going to look like. There are various scenarios that are being discussed. So when you get through with the first round, each of the participants will have selected at least one track, or potentially, if you got involved in a conflict, they might decide to split the baby. But they will all end up with a track or a portion of a track, of a single track, and they will subtract that amount of value from their total in-holding value. And then you go to round two, and I characterize it as being similar to a professional sports draft. Most people understand how that works. And you just proceed through the drafts until you're out of money, essentially. So I guess that's the reason I'm saying that potentially a participant could go into nominations and never select any track they nominated. They could work off of other people's nominations.
But see, basically what you're saying, John, and I'm following you now,
mm-hmm.
basically what you're doing is that... this land trades is really the bonus to get on there, and that maybe the underlying royalties, the 90-10, still has to prevail. That some way or other, what I'm trying to say is that you're talking about bidding now for those tracks.
No, sir, I don't believe I am.
Senator Coghill, I know exactly what you're saying, and that's precisely the point that I think we have been trying to wrestle with, is that this looks very much like non-competitive leasing, with no revenue sharing to the state, and no true competitive bidding. So in that respect, it deviates in two respects from the traditional manner in which the federal government goes about disposing of oil and gas interests in its land. And that does create serious problems from the state's perspective.
You follow what I was thinking, though. I mean, the thing is that this, the bonus that the federal government is getting is the land that you're exchanging, that you're forever going to keep for their right to drill on that land, and that there should be a royalty, overriding royalty to the state.
Well,
maybe,
I think you, if I may,
yes,
for one second more,
okay.
That hits it precisely on the head. In other words, for every $100 of oil and gas interest that the federal government is conveying to a native corporation, it is getting $100 of land value somewhere else. Whereas under the typical situation, for every $100 that the United States gives of an oil and gas interest, we get $90 and the federal government gets $10. And that is one very big distinction between this process and the normal leasing process, which we believe is part of the state of Congress.
Senator Coghill, if I could provide my perspective on this. First of all, the way I understand the valuation process of the subsurface, it's similar to a lease sale, but it's not the same valuation process.
We've got the van down there, John, and we have to go off record because they've got another run that they have to make to the ferry. We'll call the subcommittee back to order. It's 1:25. Let the record show that Senator Sturgiolowski has joined us, and we were in the middle of the of trying to sort out some of the questions, and we're going to try and head the committee into a, try and get the questions done so that at least Mr. Custer can, if possible, can go home on the early flight, because he does have so Tom will try and zero in on any of the expertise questions and the legal side of it. And I know that that's going to be kind of tough, but we'll try and get accommodate you as much as we can. We were in the middle of a conversation that we were having with Mr. Dole on working out the process and the procedures of the pool. And then we had a question, I believe, from Mr. Jones.
He was going ahead, and where were you? You were on the...
I'd attempted to kind of conceptually walk through the selection process and how that would work. I don't know if there's any further questions on that or not. And then I think I was going to attempt to characterize the exchange from our perspective, because there was the interchange between the chairman and the state on the state's perspective, and I wanted to have an opportunity to provide our characterization.
Yeah, we stopped at Vice where we were looking at the possibility that land exchange with the native communities, being the federal government getting the benefit and the private sector getting the benefit, that wasn't like a bonus instead of a royalty, and that why shouldn't there be at the table an overriding royalty for the state? And we're gonna, and maybe we can explore that just for the record, and then we'll go on to other things and see if we can kind of wind down the, I understand that in order for you to catch the airplane at a certain time, Tom, you have to be on the ferry by a certain time.
They suggested the 2:15 ferry, yeah. Possibly the 2:45. With no luggage, I could make it.
Okay, so...
But I'm at the committee's disposal. Yeah. So
I know, but we'll still try it.
I appreciate the consideration. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'd like to try to explain, I guess, briefly, conceptually, how we view the exchange and how the public interest is represented by the exchanges that we're proposing. First and foremost, I guess, we see it in a very simplified way, and this is an oversimplification, but for purposes of initiating the discussion, by saying that we see it as an exchange of a federal interest for a private interest, and to the extent that that exchange ultimately represents the public interest. It might be helpful to talk about, maybe draw an analogy to a similar exchange that was done down in Senator Jones' home country of Washington State with Weyerhaeuser Corporation back a couple years ago. In that instance, there's a large island in Willapaw Bay in the state of Washington, and Weyerhaeuser owned 1,600 acres. It was an inholding within that island. It was a 5,000-acre island. We entered into an agreement with Weyerhaeuser Corporation where we exchanged out the timber rights on that island for the fee interest in those inholdings. And that deal has essentially been consummated, although there's still some loose ends in terms of we weren't able to exchange it all out, but the concept was the same. Essentially, we were taking a federal interest in that timber and exchanging it for a fee interest in a surface estate. In that instance, I'm pretty certain, too, Weyerhaeuser kept the subsurface, just as a matter of information. That's not too dissimilar. It's somewhat analogous to what we're trying to do here, which is essentially to take an interest that's in the federal domain, at least at this point, and exchange it out for a private interest with the expectation that when this is accomplished that it represents the public interest. And I think also it's important to point out in this case that it's being done with an acute sensitivity to the impact that this is going to have on a potential leasing program on the Arctic coastal plain. It's also done, obviously, with sensitivity to the implication it has for state revenues. But at least in its simplest form, it represents an exchange of a federal interest for a private interest. And then I think the degree to which you pursue that and the balance of interests that are represented by pursuing that, as opposed to the interests that are represented in a leasing program, are something that we have to go forward and be able to represent both to you and to the public and to members of Congress, and have to be able to demonstrate that, in fact, the total concept is in the public interest. And for that matter, the Secretary has not had that opportunity yet and will not have that opportunity until we have put all the pieces of the puzzle together, we've gone to the public, We've developed the administrative record, and we make a recommendation to the secretary. Then the secretary will have to make a call looking at all the pieces of the puzzle that are on the table and how they fit together, whether the public interest is served by what we're proposing to do. And quite frankly, it's a little bit difficult to make that call at this point because, first and foremost, we haven't finished the negotiation in terms of what the agreement's going to look like. We haven't finished negotiation in terms of what values are going to be represented. We haven't finished negotiation in terms of how we're going to identify tracks. And maybe the largest unknown at this point is how much value is actually represented up there once the exchange proceeds. What's really represented? How much impact is that going to have? So I think I'm representing the Assistant Secretary's point of view in his letter to Representative Cotton when I say that we don't see it in the best public interest to try to negotiate in an open forum. And I think we're all sensitive to the need for people to know, and I think we fully intend to respond to the people's interest and their right to know. And at this point, there would be no recommendation going to the secretary with regard to public interest until the public has an opportunity to react.
Okay. And will that also be on how you're going to proceed in order to get your evaluation of the potential oil reserves and the seismic work that's been done and all the rest? That's all on the table with this, with your...
Senator Cotton, I'm not sure I can speak to the valuation, but I could discuss for you, if you would like, kind of the valuation procedure and how we're working through this thing. It might take a few minutes, but if that's of interest, I can kind of start from square one and talk about how we've entertained proposals and then move through the process to kind of get us to where we are, perhaps, in terms of at least the native corporations. Would that be helpful?
That would be helpful.
Perhaps I would prefer not to use any native corporation names. We'll say Native Corporation X. And native corporations have come to us over the course of the last 2 years and suggested in holdings that we might be interested in, and we have communicated to the native community those in holdings that are of high priority interest to us. And that information is available for the record if you would like. I don't have it with me right at this moment, but I could certainly make it available. And approximately 2 years ago, we began to scope out the prospects, what would be involved, how it might work, what the mechanism would be, and also to look at what interest we had, and I say we, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and most particularly the regional director, in actually acquiring these in-holdings. Was there sufficient interest represented there? And when I say interest, I'm talking about public interest, not simply acquiring land for the purpose of acquiring land. There had to be some significant interest there. And we began to scope that out. And in June of last year, at least one corporation came to us with a draft contract and suggested we take a look at that and wanted to begin face-to-face negotiations. We still have corporations, by the way, coming forward and making proposals, or at least entertaining the notion of making proposals. And we began to work at this level trying to sort out the magnitude and the size and the shape of the proposals that are on the table. We also began to develop the administrative record. One of the first things we do is conduct fair market appraisals, and those are done using standard appraisal practices in conformance with federal standards. In the case of the state, we were cooperating with them, and in fact, I guess it's fair to say that the appraisals have been essentially finished, although not reviewed by us, on all the state lands that were at the table back a month or so ago. The value negotiations are handled personally by Bill Horn. There's a reason for that. As you are aware, I think, ANILCA and ANSCA both provide that exchanges can occur for other than equal value. As an agency, we do not acquire land as a matter of policy for other than fair market value. And there was reason to expect that in this negotiation, because of the fair market values that are represented by some rural properties in Alaska, that we were not going to be able to do business on a willing seller basis based on fair market value. So I guess Bill Horn volunteered, the Assistant Secretary, volunteered to handle that part of the negotiation. We finish our appraisals, and we make those appraisals available for review, and they're available for review by the public, as a matter of fact. So anybody that's interested can stop by and take a look at them in our office. We make that information available to the Native Corporation. We make it available to Bill Horn so that everybody knows what our fair market value is, our fair market value appraisal. The Native Corporation then makes a counterproposal based on, in most cases, another system of valuation. In some cases, they use MIA appraisers and consultants. They use economists. and the administrative record will show where the Native Corporation has made a counterproposal. And as you might expect in any kind of an acquisition such as this, their counterproposal is higher than our fair market value appraisal. Then we get into a give-and-take process between the Assistant Secretary and the Native Corporation trying to arrive at some negotiated price that, for all intents and purposes, is going to range somewhere between fair market value and what their expectation is. I'll provide a little bit of detail on that because I think Senator Coghill was alluding to this. What we've done is established a system by which we try to measure the public attributes that a particular tract brings with it. So we don't, in the case of Native Corporation X, we don't simply say all of your acreage is of the same quality and it brings us with it the same attributes. What we do, and we're doing this, the resource managers, I don't do this personally because I'm not familiar with the acreage, but our refuge managers, our biologists, and our ascertainment, our realty people, try to assign some sense, and we do it through a form of classification where we say, for example, certain lands on Kodiak we consider to be world-class lands because of the brown bear habitat that's represented there, anadromous fishes that are represented there, the public recreation and the transactional economies because of the size of the proposal. In other words, a piece of land brings with it certain attributes that add to the public interest component. That's what it amounts to. And we have a system for assigning what we consider to be the attributes that a particular tract brings with it. But how that translates to value then is something that the Bill Horn is looking at. And quite frankly, he's using, and you'll see it in the attachment to the Representative Cotton letter, where he has indicated to the negotiating team how he intends to pursue that. And it's in large part dependent upon prior precedents, and probably the most striking of those are congressional precedents. And there are some of those, and they're alluded to in Assistant Secretary Horn's memo. So, quite frankly, that's where we are right now. Bill Horn is in the process of negotiating directly with the Native corporations over how much value they might expect to receive for their inholdings.
John, in that process, has the state in that been involved in that? Has John Katz been involved in that back in Washington, or has that just been a process between your agency and the Native corporations?
Senator, that is just a process, at least as it relates to the parties. Between the Native Corporation and Assistant Secretary Horn. Of course, there have been discussions of value between the state and Assistant Secretary Horn, but only as it relates to the value that the state inholdings would bring to the table and presumably some other value kinds of questions concerning overrides and that sort of thing.
I'll get into that with BLM when we get BLM to the table, but is there a difference in evaluation system between the inholdings in parks and the inholdings in refuge? In other words, are there two different structures that you're setting up here?
Senator, I can't speak specifically to that issue, but my understanding would be and my expectation would be that a similar kind of a process would be used, whether it be Park Service, as long as we're talking about surface. Park Service and refuge kinds of inholdings, they both bring certain kinds of public attributes with them.
Senator Jones.
Well, the state's lands are refuge-type lands also that were...
Yes, sir.
This batch. This batch. Right. I was trying to get their batch up to
okay, you're talking about parks also.
Yeah.
Parkland.
Yeah. Well, the we understand from what discussion we've had that there's 800,000 acres and there's 1,200,000 acres. And I was trying to see if we could get both of them up to about the same, but like you say, acreages don't necessarily mean values.
That's correct. It varies with the acreages involved. Yes, sir. Now, if I might take this kind of one step further in terms of how you get to the selection process, before a Native corporation is allowed to move forward and be a participant in the selection process, there will be a signed agreement that says, here's what's being offered, the land description will be there, the tracts will be identified, they will be classified, there will be a value attached to those, and there will be a signed agreement between the Assistant Secretary and the Native participant, and it says, you have Y number of dollars associated with your inholding. And the analogy I would make is that you take a checkbook into the selection process, and each Native participant, each Native corporation has a balance in that checkbook that they can pursue in selecting tracts. Now, the other side of this...
See, that's the reason why I brought... John, that's the reason why the lights came on, that this is... You're treating these land trades more in a bonus position than you are in a royalty position, because the Native community is getting is getting, on one hand, a value received, and the federal government's getting a value received, but there's no underwriting or overriding royalty that's going to the public sector or to the state.
That's correct, Senator. And let me take, kind of conceptually try to explain, I guess, our perspective on that. The way the valuation of the subsurface has occurred on the Arctic tracks, the way I understand it, and my friends from BLM may go into more detail on this, essentially those tracks and those subsurface interests are being valued based on what they would represent in a fair market. If we were to take a track up there of 2,560 acres and we went to an oil company interest and said, okay, we are interested in selling you this track, and we're going to sell it to you with a lot of baggage tied to it about what you can do and what you can't do and when you can do it. And based on that, we think that track is worth Z number of dollars. Mm-hmm. Would you like it? And if they like it, they say, yes, we like it. And we give the federal government Z number of dollars, and we take that Z number of dollars and go down and buy out the private in holdings from the native corporations. That's another, conceptually, another way to look at it. We're using the subsurface interests and the values that are represented there as a form of tender, in effect. And the other thing I think you have to keep in mind is that no matter what price is ultimately negotiated between the native corporation and the assistant secretary, that price only represents value to the extent that it buys them something on the Arctic. And right now, those native corporations have no way of knowing what it's going to buy them, and they won't know until a couple days before they move into selections. But it is possible, it's totally possible, and it wouldn't surprise me too much, I guess, personally, but what some of the native corporations could take a look at those values and say simply, you know, we can't buy enough up there to make it worth our while. We can't sell it to our shareholders. And if we can't sell it to our shareholders, we're not going to waste your time and our time. We're through. We're walking from the table. The other prospect is that they go through the selection process. They acquire one, two, three tracks, whatever it is they end up with, and they then take that forward and try to propose it in the way of an exchange to their shareholders and sell them on the idea that the balancing of risks are appropriate. And
that's where it's at, really.
That's right. And I'm not sure in my own mind how you can test the balancing of those risks and whether they're risks worth taking until you know what you're going to get. And that's what the native corporations, that's the way they tend to relate it to us. They don't know what they're getting. And until they know what they're getting, they're not in a position to represent that, in fact, other than conceptually, that they're ready to buy off on this exchange concept.
So,
Senator Sturtevant.
Through the chair. John, since this will be a signed agreement, and obviously then is contingent upon congressional okay, do you see Congress having to deal just with the contract, either up or down? You know, I don't know if there's any assurance in that, and the only thing we have that would be like that in the state would be the royalty oil contracts, and they have been changed, but it's not done very lightly, I can assure you. It means that you send the administration back to renegotiate as opposed to the legislature setting new terms.
Senator, I really don't know. I wish I did. I guess it's a similar kind of a situation with the 90-10 revenue split. Congress has the prerogative to do anything they want with the contracts. I guess they choose to pursue that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess what I'd like to do is I'd like to kind of shift gears, if it's all right, with the committee and see if we can get a couple questions asked by Tom, so in case he can get out of here, we can let him go, and we'll keep Gary here, and he can wing all of the legal questions. on Bill Horn's letter to Sam Cotton on page 5, I guess the meat of what we were talking about, and it's one of the things that I had written down 3 or 4 days ago, and that middle paragraph there, he says, "Finally, in addition to the above matters, your letter addresses several issues of specific concern to the state of Alaska. These include revenue sharing, the state's claim to the title of certain submerged lands within Anwar and elsewhere, and the exchange of state-owned park in holdings. In several places, you suggest that the state has a vested interest in receiving 90% of the proceeds from the mineral development on federal lands in Alaska." And I think we covered that. The only existing mineral revenue sharing commitment made to the state is found in Section 28 of the Statehood Act. It's found in a couple other places, isn't it, Tom? It's not just found in the Statehood Act. It's also a part of the 57 agreement, wasn't it? Go ahead.
The 90-10 formula is set out explicitly in the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
For Alaska. It also, that formulation was also incorporated in the Alaska Statehood Act in Section 28. So the state now has, in effect, two claims, the way we view it. One is the same generic claim that other Western states have to a share of federal leasing revenues. And the second is the fact that it, in fact, was expressly noted by Congress at the time Alaska was admitted to the Union and incorporated as what Congress termed in the House report on the statehood bill, a, quote, major provision of the Statehood Act, which is sort of where our compact argument stems from, the fact that Congress viewed this revenue sharing as a major provision of statehood. That is one of the major considerations that came to Alaska in return for accepting both the benefits and the burdens of statehood through the mutual acceptance by Congress of our Constitution and in our Constitution the provisions of the Statehood Act.
Yeah, I think we understand that one. But then he goes on and he says the proceeds derived from the exchanges, disposal or leases under other authorities are not covered by Section 28 of the Statehood Act. Those are those public land orders, basically.
I think what he's referring to here.
Then
would
he says,
be,
"Yeah, well, he goes on, and we got to go, and we got to read it in its full context." Then he goes on to say, "Congress has the authority, has the discretion to set the revenue sharing formula at 50% in the legislation that authorized leasing in the National Petroleum Reserve, 50%. He can do that. That they can do that here."
I think that's what he's saying.
Yeah.
When he refers to exchanges, disposals, or leases under other authorities are not covered by Section 20 of the Alaska Statehood Act. For example, if the United States obtains subsurface in exchange or through purchase, say it purchases subsurface, those lands acquired by the United States would be termed acquired lands. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to lease them, it would be leased under the authority of the Mineral Leasing Act for Acquired Lands of 1947, which is a different act than the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920. The Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 applies to public domain lands, that is, lands that have never been in private ownership.
Yeah.
So they were part of the territory as originally purchased by the government, the federal government, in Alaska's case, from Russia, through the Treaty of Cession. So that would be leasing on acquired lands is under different authority than the Mineral Leasing Act. And so that leasing would not be covered by the 90-10 split. It would be covered by the provisions of the Mineral Leasing Act. Similarly, if they disposed of timber under a statute authorizing timber disposal, we're not entitled necessarily to 90% of that because we're only entitled to 90% under the Mineral Leasing Act as incorporated in the Statehood Act, and timber disposal is not covered by the Mineral Leasing Act. So that's a different disposal authority that they would be using. Where I'm coming from is that the expectation of Congress at the time of statehood was that if federal lands in Alaska were to be leased for oil and gas development, they would be leased under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920. That's the authority Congress created for leasing federal lands, generically, throughout the public land states, all the western states and Alaska. It's a system that has been tried over time. It's been proven over time. There are a series of regulations that govern the leasing process, that govern the accounting process, that govern the royalty process, that govern the bidding process. You know, the whole leasing system is covered under the Mineral Leasing Act. And Congress's expectation in the Statehood Act, I believe the legislative history shows, was that in the event of oil and gas leasing in the state of Alaska, that leasing would be conducted under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, not under some newly created leasing legislation, which would start the process all over and, in effect, duplicate what we already have in the 1920 Act. So that if leasing does go forward, it will go forward under the 1920 Leasing Act. The only exception to the 1920 Leasing Act are naval petroleum reserves and oil shale reserves. And NPRA was a naval petroleum reserve. So both in the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 and in its incorporation into the Statehood Act, NPRA was exempted from that 90-10 requirement. So when they authorized leasing in 1980 and provided that the states could get 50% of any revenues derived by the federal government from that leasing, we got 50% where we were entitled under the Compact and Mineral Leasing Act to nothing. So we went from 0 to 50.
Yeah.
So, in my view, I disagree with Assistant Secretary Horn that Congress can do whatever it wants with the rest of public lands in Alaska. The Congress that admitted Alaska to the Union already made that determination.
So your position is that the Congress hasn't... We've got this here oil and gas leasing status of ANWR, where... And have you seen this, Tom?
I don't believe so, Senator.
Take a look at this, and where they have... We have a sequence of events that goes back to 1943, really. Public land orders that kind of brings us up through a system. So the last paragraph in John Horn's, or the last sentence in John Horn's letter saying that Congress possess similar discretion if it chooses to enact new legislation opening ANWR to oil is the area that you do not agree with that then.
I do not believe that Congress has
the right to
plenary discretion to deviate from the 90-10 formula. I'm sure that there are, you know, I'd make no contention that I'm all wise. Mm-hmm. Certainly judges can have different views. But the point I'm trying to make, I think, is that there is a very strong, very credible legal argument that Alaska can make based on the Statehood Act, the solemn compact with the United States under which we were admitted, that in the event of oil and gas leasing of the federal lands that comprise the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that Alaska is entitled to 90% of the revenues derived by the federal government from that leasing.
Look at the fourth paragraph down. I guess that's where the key is, where the Waller, yeah. The rejections were litigated in. It says there, all lease applications to the east of these leases were rejected. These rejections were litigated in Waller versus Hickel, and the court found in favor of the government. This is in late 1960, BLM prepared a leasing map consisting of Suet. And I'm not asking you to make a knee-jerk decision, but I'm saying we're trying to get to the core of that because as chairman, I agree with the position that the 90-10 has got, that there's some real heavy strings attached to that 90-10 because it's in the compact.
If I can speculate on this, if I'm reading this correctly, the issue was whether the lands east of the Canning River, that is in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, were available for leasing over the Secretary's objection or not. And in this case, applications were filed for leasing, and the Secretary said, no, I'm rejecting those applications. In other words, the Secretary said, I don't want leasing to go forward in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge here in the late 60s. And if I'm reading this correctly, that was what the litigation was over, and the court upheld the authority of the Secretary to reject the applications. But it really didn't go to the question of whether
Congress had.
Whether leasing would be permitted if the Secretary decided to let it go forward. What it, in fact, was at issue was his decision that I don't want it to go forward. And the court is saying, if you don't want it to go forward, then it doesn't. Similarly, if the Secretary wanted it to go forward prior to the closure in Anilka, mm-hmm. he would have had the authority to permit it to go forward. Obviously, what Congress does controls the Secretary's discretion. So when Congress closed ANWR in Anilka to oil and gas leasing, the Secretary has no alternative but to abide by that closure because it is a congressional closure.
Senator Jones.
Well, I see this leading into to one answer. We're going to let this thing, the state's view at this point seems to be that we're going to let these negotiations go. We could care less what the government and the native corporations do, because when it gets right down to the point where if it ever gets opened up to exploration and development, the state's going to file an injunction if we don't get the 90-10. Is that correct?
It's
speculation.
Well, I think it's
that's speculation, but I see that this is the hard-nosed position of the state at this time, it seems like.
Well, I think that the governor has made clear through his statement that he's not closing the door to land exchanges, that the state retains an open mind. And I think what it basically means in terms of hypotheticals is that the most desirable option for the state from this point is that the Arctic National Wildlife Range be open to oil and gas development under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 with the 90-10 formula. To the extent there are any changes from that, whether they involve land exchanges, changes to the 90-10 formula, or purported changes to the 90-10 formula by Congress, then that's a situation that we'll have to deal with at that time and assess the precise mix of whatever Congress throws into the pot and make a determination, is in fact that in the state's best interest to allow it to go forward under those terms and conditions, or is it not? But at this time, you can't really know what it is going to be without having a view of that whole mix. So you can't really say, is it in the state's best interest or is it not in the state's best interest, because there are too many unknowns. We do know one thing that would be in the state's best interest, and in fact is the best of all worlds from the state's perspective, and that is that it be opened to oil and gas leasing under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, period.
Ms. Chairman?
Senator,
your comment begs, I think, a question, and maybe there's not an answer that you can give, but you say that the state is not necessarily opposed to the land trades. But what we're trying to struggle in this whole thing is not only if there's a way to reach consensus on the state's position, but timing and other information. So how do you see, as representing the administration, of this thing coming together? When is there information? When did the train leave the station? And when is there an opportunity to be involved in it? And I guess a question right now is, what's happening right now? You know, how is the state protecting the interest or attempting to determine the interest of the public in this manner?
Well, I think at this point, the determination has been made from the administration's perspective that the trades in their current format and under the current timetable for finalizing those exchange agreements is not in the state's interest. And so in that sense, as currently structured and as currently timed, the state does not favor the exchanges going forward. That's not to say that at an appropriate time, meaning after Congress has addressed the primary issue, so that the debate can be focused on the primary issue, and that is, should it be opened or should it not be opened, then it may or may not be appropriate at that point to look at exchanges as one way of advancing the responsible exploration and development of oil and gas reserves in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Well, just to pursue that with one more question, Mr. Chairman. If that's true, then, I mean, if that, obviously, then is reflecting the state's position, so you're not involved at the table, what is the state doing to advance the primary question, then, of getting this issue before Congress and addressing the issue?
Well, as you know, there is a bill pending for both the supplemental appropriation and in the governor's budget, a line item for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge effort in Congress, which if the legislature sees fit to appropriate the money for that effort, will then be going forward. In the meantime, and in the absence of that appropriation and at least a specifically identified pot of money to advance the state's interest in opening the refuge, we are continuing to maintain and enhance, to the extent we are able, contacts with Congress, contacts with constituents, contacts with this committee, with the legislature, to ensure that the issue is explored and that as many of the facts as can be laid out on the table are laid out on the table, and we do get as much information to the public, to legislators, to the administration, and particularly to Congress on that fundamental question that, in fact, in our view, both from a state perspective and from a national perspective, it is appropriate and desirable to open the refuge to responsible oil and gas development. So the actions are continuing on that front, And I know that's where the governor would like to see this debate focus, is on that fundamental issue.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. Senator Sturgis came in.
So you are not then working on what might be a trade or might be in the best interest of the state to pursue. You're not developing that. I mean, if somebody, if Mr. Doble comes over and says, here's a nice package, would you look at it? You would obviously look at it. But you're not doing work to attempt to find if there are, in fact, areas in which the state might be interested or would pursue.
With the chair's permission, Senator Sturgis-Lewski, as you recall, last Saturday I did articulate several alternatives to the exchanges that the administration is considering, the overriding royalty, the bid shed process. The governor, again, has said the door is not shut to state participation or consideration of land exchanges. We are actively examining alternatives.
Yeah. And if I might,
and that
might
was
add,
an excellent paper too.
We're certainly not limiting ourselves to those that have been identified. There may well be a myriad of options or alternatives out there, and they would all receive consideration because this is, as everyone seems to recognize, probably the most significant oil and gas deal that's going to happen between now and the year 2000. And to close one's mind to any conceivable alternative that may have potential benefits is not in the public interest at this point. And so I think the administration is remaining as open as possible to the myriad variety of alternatives and options that are available. Unfortunately, the one that is currently percolating does not appear at this time and in this format to be the one that ought to be seized on.
Senator Jones.
Regardless of how you feel about that, that negotiation is moving on. And when they do reach an agreement in principle, so forth, and Congress does, in their wisdom, open up ANWR under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, what happens? Isn't it a little bit late then for the state to come in and say, hey, wait a minute, we want to share that? We want to be part of this?
It's only late in the sense, or it's only too late if Congress, in addition to opening the mineral, the refuge to leasing under the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920, also ratifies the agreements. I think that's, hopefully that's a scenario that will not develop, but it may well develop that the state will have no alternative but to oppose those agreements if in fact they are finalized and presented to Congress. And we hope that that's not the case. But that may be the only option available at that point.
Go ahead. Because you see, the land, the exchange should go ahead and the Native Corporation would have those rights to those tracts that they've nominated. Anyway.
No. That's not our understanding from the representations that have been made to us by the Department of Interior. Is that these exchanges will not go forward under the department's administrative authority, that they will only go forward if they are approved by Congress.
Is that correct, John?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
But they, you know, that could all happen in one motion in Congress. I mean, they could open it up, plus award the go ahead with the land exchange at the same time.
No, that, well, Senator, that's not our understanding. Our understanding is that the Secretary is going to come in, that they're going to come in with their recommendation from testimony, and then they're going to proceed with the land exchange, or open up for a land exchange. I guess your concern, or our concern here, is will that door be shut for that to go forward from Interior to the Congress without the state being involved in it? I think that's getting to the core issue. Is that what you're basically, because they're not going to be together.
Well the land exchange is going to be worth a darn if they don't, if they have to open up.
Yeah, they could.
ANWR for open for
could be.
I think the governor's sense is that at this point in time, the potential for gain in the negotiation process is not as great as the potential for advancing both the state's and the nation's interest in the congressional debate, is what it amounts to.
Does that answer your question? Senator.
Tom, as I understand it, what we're really betting on, I mean, assuming that the decision to make to open ANWR is made, then how the state gets back into the exchange process is Congress doesn't approve the exchanges. I mean, we're betting that Congress won't, if the state's not involved, approve the exchanges. Is that right?
Or approve a different version of exchanges that we feel is more in the state's interest.
Or we'll approve a different version. Where's our congressional delegation on land exchanges? Question.
Are they like this with the administration, or are they like this?
I'm not sure we could answer that.
Yeah. I guess I get the impression that our congressional delegation is supporting land exchanges. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I can't speak for it, but I get that impression. I guess I wonder, you know, how you make the judgment, and maybe you're right. I'm just trying to figure out how you make the judgment that the decision to open ANWR is made, and that even though our congressional delegation may be in favor of land exchanges, the state will be able to slow this all down in Congress and either get it changed or stopped altogether. That's the next step, right? I mean, Congress is our next step. Beyond that, then it's an injunction or something.
And I guess my sense is that it would be helpful if the committee could get a reading from the congressional delegation.
Who will?
I have not had any dealings with them, and my general impression is that there is sort of a range of feeling among the three members of our delegation that at least is not... can at least be characterized as saying, don't rush into exchanges, because my understanding is the delegation has been urging a slowing down of the process and at least a delay of the track selection. What that means in the broad scheme of things, I don't really know, and I think it would be inappropriate to comment on the delegation's position.
Senator, in talking to the congressional delegation, the only signal that I got was the signal that I was trying to get verified this morning, and that was that it's a political thing on the Hill that if the land exchanges don't go forward, the environmental program, they were getting the support not from the environmentalists because they like the native corporations or the land, it's the land that they're going to get in the Togiak and the land that they're going to get in the Delta and those places, that land, that's what's rising the interest.
Well, I got the impression, I don't know whether it was when Senator Stephen Sierkowski spoke to us or when it was, that they were favoring land exchanges and the land exchange process. And that's why I asked that question, because it appears to me that if the state is counting on congressional action to slow down the land exchange process, if we're apart from a congressional delegation, we got a real tough battle. And it's a judgment, I guess, but it appears to me that makes it real difficult.
Well, you know, an analysis of yours, Senator, is that you're saying that we don't know whether that, when the Secretary comes down, whether he's going to bring the whole package in at one shot. If that's the case, then it would seem to me that it would be to the state's best interest to get back to that table just as fast as we possibly can, or to get assurance that it's going to be split. I mean, have you got that? Has anybody talked about that to you, to the state?
I know that John Katz has an agreement with Bill Horn that the state will continue to be briefed on the process and where it is in the process so that we can periodically reevaluate our options, reevaluate decisions that are made. The one consideration, obviously, is that the more involved the state is in the negotiations, and the longer the state remains involved in the negotiations, the more difficult it becomes if at the conclusion of that negotiating process we look at the package of exchanges that's put together and say, this is not a good deal.
But what do you think then, Tom, what's going to stop us? I mean, what stops it? What stops the process?
That's where
Congress?
Yes.
Congressional action.
Absolutely.
Because it's not an interior action, it's a congressional action.
Or a necessary court.
But if they've got their balances in Congress, which were the environmental community, backing them because the environmental community, and that's my position, is that if the environmental community which Udall and Siebeling and those people have got a tremendous amount of stroke in Congress, particularly now with both of the houses on that side of the aisle, that the Togiak exchange and stuff like that's going to override any interest that we have.
Mr. Chairman.
Do you understand what I'm saying? I think that corresponds.
I think I do, and part of that, I don't think either Gus or I are in a position to, you know,
yeah.
to analyze Congress or to take a poll among the members of Congress at this point. all we can do, I guess, is reflect the judgments that have been made, and that is that the judgments of those who, to the extent they are able to glean those kinds of sensitivities, have concluded, in fact, that at this point in time and in this format and in the way these are being put together, that they have more of an adverse effect than an advantageous effect in terms of the ultimate goal, which is opening the refuge to responsible oil and gas development.
So if you analyze that position, and we take that, and I'm not arguing with, because all you have to do is say tilt, and that's a policy position that goes up to the third floor, and we appreciate that, and we understand. But if you analyze that scenario and that position down to the last degree, it would say that it would be playing into the hands of the people that are on the opposite side of the interest of the governor, in playing into the hands of the people that want to keep the place closed and not open. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I can only speak for myself on this one, not for the administration, but there is certainly a plausible argument that can be made that this current process is in fact destined to result in the refuge remaining closed. The exchange process as it's going through, and as the debate turns from should it be open or not to the wisdom of these exchanges.
Yeah, I know.
A very plausible result is that the main issue gets lost because of the focus of debate on exchanges.
Senator Sturgeon.
Through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I guess that we're all trying to arrive at a way to go. I mean, we don't have a nice, easy course. But twice now, Tom, you've referred to the fact that the longer the state stays in, the more difficult it is to come back. You did that a week ago, and you're doing it now. As Congress must approve the land trade, I think anything of significance involving the state in trade would, in fact, involve legislative approval. So I guess I have a little bit of problem seeing that Congress, although a sovereign, it seems to me, would want to have the government, the legislature, and the administrative position similar in a land exchange. I can't imagine Congress going through on a major change that involved the state's interests in specific land without legislative approval. So it seems to me that just by our system of government, we have those checks and balances. In fact, that if you couldn't say no, damn well, we could say no. So I guess I have a little trouble with the statement that it gets harder to say no.
Say no to what?
Well, no to being involved in the land trades, because I think you've got a legislature as a check and balance to, say, administrative action.
Do you want to respond?
Maybe there's not an answer to that.
I'm not sure that there is an answer. It seems to me that the kind of negotiation that was going on, in which the state participated, is effectively an executive branch function. Executive branch is geared to do that. I mean, you can get into
That's right.
Of the angels on the head of the pin kind of argument. And it's a legitimate executive function to participate in that.
Right.
But it's also a legitimate executive discretion to determine that it no longer is in the state's interest. I think it's a very legitimate legislative function to inquire into that decision.
Mr. Chairman,
That's what's going on here, I think, is the inquiry into the executive's decision that it was no longer in the state's interest to participate.
Yeah, but Mr. Chairman, again, back to your statement, which, as I say, you've made twice, that if you involved, it gets harder to say no. It seemed to me there's always a safety valve in requiring legislative action to either agree or disagree with that. I mean, if that's the reason for dropping out, that doesn't seem like a very strong reason to me.
And even beyond
Senator Duncan.
It seems to me, and I guess we've gone over this ground so many times, I don't know what we're ever going to gain from it, but seems to me that by withdrawing from the negotiations, it doesn't shift the focus. Those continue. I said that this morning. Secondly, it just appears to me that if Congress is where we really are going to have to make our last stand, right, as to whether those exchanges are approved or disapproved, it seems to me we've got a better case with Congress if we've been participating all along. And we, after we participate and we've tried to influence what's been happening and we know exactly what's been going on and we finally say, wait, this is not in our best interest, it seems to me we can make a better case to Congress, a state case, it's not in our best interest, than if we've withdrawn 3 months earlier and not participated. You know, if someone came to me and said, we don't like what's going on, and here's why, would make a better case with me than if they came to me and said, we don't like what's going on, and we didn't even participate. So I guess what I'm wondering is why, you know, kind of along with Senator Sturgeon's question, I don't think it's ever too late to say no. In fact, I think it gives you a better case to say no if you participated and are not satisfied.
Tom, I guess we're pounding on you a little bit. I'm trying to watch the clock, see, because Senator Jones.
Well, I was just wondering,
yeah,
doesn't that make
that make? Could you wish to comment on that, or are we in tilt?
I don't think we're quite in tilt. We're leaning, but Senator Duncan, that's certainly a plausible, defensible position to take. On the other hand, the state did take a considerable amount of time and effort to participate, to find out what was going on, to get involved. The question is whether we should continue to stay after we got a distasteful taste in our...